Mr. Aldrill, too. Well, we were talking about air raid shelters. Did you have an Anderton air raid shelter as well?
No. One of the main reasons why we didn't have an Anderton, because our property was one that was very low lying, and in the winter the garden was always flooded anyway, so it would have been no use. But there was a communal brick shelter built outside the front of these flats, which would hold a few people, and they had bunks in there. But they're just ordinary brick shelters. They would have been some use, I suppose, against shrapnel, but not the slightest against bombs or anything like that.
Did you ever go in that?
No, nobody ever went in that for some reason, as far as I know. People, after a while, except perhaps in really well-blitzed areas, hardly made use of their shelters, I believe. They felt if it was going to happen, it was going to happen. They was going to have a fairly good night's sleep, best as they could in their ordinary bed. And ours, apart from some of the things I have said, it wasn't a heavily blitzed area. It was just the odd occasions, uncomfortable.
What about the blackout? Could you tell us about that, how it was done in your house or flat?
Yes, the blackouts, curtains, you just made of any material. But the first thing we did as soon as we were told the war was in progress, you've got to do something, we stuck the sticky sellotape all over the windows, so you had crisscross patterns on all your windows to try and save the glass, and then
To stop flying glass.
yes, really, to so that if you did have a bomb and the windows were blown out, at least they came out in more or less in one piece, rather than hundreds of pieces where you'd be cut to death. The blackout curtains, you just had to use whatever materials as you could, and you'd put them up and you'd go outside and somebody else would switch the light on inside and you'd have a look, and if that was okay, that was it. In most cases, the wardens were very sharp on anything like this. You had the slightest glimmer of light and they'd be shouting, knocking on the door. In fact, I can give you another war story about this. There was another night when we had a raid. It wasn't actually near us, and how much of it we would have heard, I'm not really sure. But this again was when I was working down at Everett and Edgcumbe's, where we were told that they'd hit Colindale Underground Station. And of course, during the lunch hour, we all went out the back way and had a look, and it was terrible. This is the next day. They'd actually flattened the station, and there's still bits and pieces hanging on trees around about. And I was talking to one person about it who lived down there. I think it's somebody who was working at Everett and Edgcumbe's. And he said, yeah, it was tragic, he said, because old Science, I forget, he said the name, who was the air raid warden, he said he was walking down by the station and he could see a light. He said he went in there to complain, and then up went the station and never found him. And what it's supposed to have been was a landmine coming down by parachute. And Hendon Aerodrome, of course, is only a few yards away, but it landed direct on into the station. And this part of it, I don't know whether it's true or not, but and I believe part of it is true. There was two underground trains in at the time. One came from the London direction, and one came from Edgware direction, and of course they were right under where the landmine landed. But of course, I can't vouch for anything like that. I know a lot of people were killed.
And what about you work as a fire watcher? Can you tell us about, or you volunteering as a fire watcher? Was that at Everett?
No, my dad's firm, just down at Cricklewood.
So, what job was that? Tell me about that job first.
Well, I was. Working there was just an ordinary boy that did general work. But One of the things.
Where?
This is Crickwood, sorry, Ox Gateway. Isn't it amazing now? You can always remember these things except when you want to.
Don't worry.
First of all, one of the products we made was gumption. It's a well-known soap in those days for cleaning, washing, you know. Another thing it made was a stuff called mastican. Now, this was specially made for the war effort. It was a mixture of scrim, which is fine, like curtain material, mixed with pitch or tar and asbestos, which of course nowadays we're not happy about. And this would be put on all the roofs of stations, King's Cross Station and many other places. It uses the blackout material, and of course it acted to stick the glass together, save any splintering. But obviously the factory used a lot of flammable products, tar, pitch, scrim and everything else. So all around the factory there was...
This is on Cricklewood?
This is the one at Cricklewood. I should probably remember the name later on, but...
It's okay.
I can't... I can't remember straight. And all the way around the factory, there was always barrels full of water in case of a fire, in case of incendiaries. And every night, there had to be a rota of people to do fire watching. So we took it in turns, and although there's about three of us that were fairly young, we still had a turn because that we were paid for. So of course that was quite an incentive.
Now, what was your job as a fire watcher then? What would you do when it was your rotated turn?
Well, all you would do really is to, in my case, being a young person, sleep and be called by one or two of the older people if you need it. In fact, you slept with all your clothes on, and I slept on the snooker table, actually. It'd be uncomfortable now, but it didn't seem to be uncomfortable in those days. And we never received any training. I suppose the fact that I'd been trained as a supplementary fire party's member, they expected that I should be able to handle a syrup pump and all the necessary items. But we never had any trouble. We never had any incendiaries drop there or anything like that. So.
Now, what about what were you actually doing at the factory?
My job was nothing else but just helping to put water in canisters, mixing up soap, carrying bits and pieces from here to there, and I suppose just a general run around. Oh, one of the other jobs that I also had, which was very interesting, I was a van boy. We had one big lorry, which was a Leyland Cub, and old Fred Woods, the driver, a wonderful old person, he used to take all the goods around, and very often, if there's a lot of stuff to be taken, then I'd go along with the van boy. And we used to go down to the docks. We used to go down to East India Dock and all around the area, and we got caught in one or two air raids down there, although we never ran into trouble, fortunately. But I could see at first hand some of the bombing and some of the dogfighting above with our aircraft and the German bombers. That was very interesting. But apart from the job, I never learnt anything. He was the one who interested in me in driving, that's all. And he'd graduated from the horse and car up to this Leyland Cub open lorry.
Now, one thing we haven't asked about is rationing. What about food rationing? How did that affect your life?
Well, it wasn't too bad, really. It's the type of thing that you got used to. And your parents... no matter how bad they might be at cooking, for instance, always managed to cope. You You always manage to get something or other. And I think really the fact that when we were young, and when we were a bit older, there was so much of a shortage of money in the family that we could cope on very little. I know in the early days when I said we lived at Netherwood Street, it was bread and jam, really. I can remember that as a staple diet, bread and jam, or condensed milk on jam, on bread, which are two things. And of course, you went on to things like dripping, if you ever had any meat, but that would only be on a Sunday, you'd have meat, and that wasn't too often.
So the rationing didn't make much difference because you'd never had much to start with.
I think this is what I can safely say. Yes, you used to buy bread, and you found that things like jam were cheap, things like condensed milk was cheap, and all this type of thing. If you bought meat before the rationing, it would be the cheap cut of meat anyway. It'd be the scrag end of lamb, and so therefore, when it came to rationing, you weren't really bothered.
What about clothing rationing? Because that came in as well. Did that affect you much, or was it the same thing?
Well, it, really, as far as I was concerned, it's about the same thing, because you never worried about clothes in general. You always put on a better type of clothes on a Sunday if you went out anywhere. Like if we were going down to Petticoat Lane, Club Row, we only had to walk down the bottom of the road and get on the train to Broad Street and in that direction, and you just put on the better clothes that you had and just went out for the day. That was your best clothes. So we weren't really affected, you know, to any great degree. I think, if anything, probably sweets we might have missed as kids, more than anything in the way of food, you know, when they were short.
Because you were still only about 16, 17. And you like sweets?
Well, it was 17 when I joined the Navy. Well, I volunteered for the Navy. After doing fire washing for a couple of years, I thought, well, it's about time I got a bit more into this war.
And why did you feel that? Because not everybody feels that, you know.
Well, you say that, but in the environment at that time, it was a completely different situation. Everybody that I can think of, except the people who, I suppose, used to make money on the side and didn't want to go into the war, and the crafty dodgers. But most of the others, you wanted to get into the war. It wasn't a case you wanted to kill people. Nobody felt that they wanted to kill someone, but they wanted to stop the Germans taking over the country. So you wanted to get into the war. And I think a lot of people were like that. Who I met anyway. So anyway, I've been doing this fire washing for a couple of years, I say, and I thought I need to get in, do a little bit more. I don't feel like I'm doing enough. So I don't know whether there might have been a special day or something, but I was just 17. This was in 1943, and I went up to Deansbrook Road drill hall, and
asked that about in Kingsbury? Where?
That is at Burntoak at Edgware, actually. Deansbrook Road drill hall. It's a well-known.
It's not
still
far
there.
From Kingsbury. I mean,
not very far. No, it's a well-known place anyway. Yeah, it's just outside the Kingsbury area, the nearest one. There's two drill halls, Kingsbury drill hall, and this one. But for some reason, I went there. So whether they had a special day where you could volunteer or something at that drill hall. So I went up there, as I say, I was just 17, and said I wanted to join the Navy.
Why the Navy?
I don't really know. I'd joined the Royal Artillery Cadets, that's the Army Cadets, for a short while.
They hadn't mentioned that, we'll come back to that, but yeah, carry on.
I'd joined, and I'd been a few days with the Air Force Cadets, which is up at Deansbrook Road Drill Hall, And somehow the army didn't appeal to me. And I knew if I joined the Air Force, with my lack of schooling and everything, I'd just be an ordinary person, you know, doing anything else but fighting a war, which I thought. So I thought, I'll join the Navy. And of course, I could swim like a fish, so I thought that would be a good help. And so it happens, it wouldn't be a great help, strange enough.
Now, where did you went to Dean, what happened when you got to Dean's Rook at Road Drill Hall? Can you remember how this sort
yeah,
of...
Yeah, I remember quite a bit, but not exactly the same. I remember at the time I went there, whether it was that time or later, but they said at the time I went there, first of all, when I was 17, they said, well, I'm sorry, you're too young. We can't take you at the age of 17. But they said, if you like to state a preference now, and you are prepared to go in for a grade which will take a 6 month training, then we can call you at 17 and a half, because then you will be 18 when you're trained and you will be officially allowed to go to sea. It so happens that they do have people going to sea that were under 18, but that's the official. So I said, right, that's fair enough, I'll do that. So at some time, rather, whether it was then or some other time, there I had a medical there at that centre. So they gave you a full medical.
And how strict was it, do you think?
I think because you was a volunteer, it's stricter than I've heard of people that were called up, actually. And they tested your hearing there. Now, I think they must have just looked at your eyes and looked at your teeth, because at some time before I actually was called, I had to go down to Burnt Oak and go to an optician's there and have my eyes tested, and they sent the information to the Admiralty or whoever. And also, when I'd had the check at the drill hall, they had said, well, we won't accept you into the Navy till you have your teeth done. You've got some bad teeth. And in those days, everybody was scared of the dentist, me as well. And so I had to have four molars out of the back, which were, you know, quite a thing. And usually in those days, you had to pay for everything yourself. Unless, of course, it was paid for. I can't recall that. Those days, you never had injections, you had gas, and that was terrible. You didn't feel anything, but when you were having the gas, you had to hold you down because you struggled and you shouted because you were being suffocated. You know, I can remember all that as though it was yesterday. And I always say that the bravest thing I ever did was to have my four teeth out volunteering in the Navy. So, and I passed. After that,
was there an intelligence test?
Yes,
a sort of schooling test.
There, I can't remember about most of the tests, but the aptitude test I can definitely remember.
What was that?
You had a box, or what I think they give the kids now sometimes, all different shapes, with all the different shapes to fit into the holes. It's amazing how many of them couldn't do it. But I mean, you know, you got things like a clover leaf, or square, or triangle, rectangle, and you had to put those into the...
Sounds pretty easy, I mean...
It seemed easy to me. It, you know, perhaps it wasn't for everybody, but it seemed... And the other three questions they asked, I can't remember, I'm afraid, anything else.
Right, so you passed all this. Now, what I would like to do is just go back a bit. And what about your time with the artillery?
Before we just go, one of the important things they said is that they couldn't accept me without a signature from a parent, because I was underage. So I went back home, and my mother said, no way. She'd lost a brother who had badly wounded in the last war, and he died shortly afterwards. And she already had my brother, who was in the army, and I believe was out in Africa then, so fighting. So she said no, and so, of course, I asked my dad. And he said, well, with you and made up your mind and you want to do it. He said, if I was able to, I'd do it. So he signed and that's all right. So
that was that. And what about this previous experience you'd had? Tell me, take them in turn. What about what exactly were you in the cadets? The army, the garrison?
First of all, I was in the scouts. And the scouts, our leader, he lived down near the drill hall at Kingsbury, which is not all that far away. And when this is quite early in the war, and when there was some raids by planes, he used to talk about these different things. So I said, well, I'd like to join something. He said, well, the drill hall's just down there. He said, that's the Royal Artillery Drill Hall. Why didn't you go in there and have a look at them? So I did. I went and had a look at them, and they were quite interesting. I'd have bought myself a uniform. I got myself a uniform.
And what exactly were you joining here?
The Royal Artillery Cadet Force, which really didn't tie you down to anything. All you did was to go along and do drill and learn various things about guns, I suppose. To be quite honest, I'm not sure how long I was with them, but I can't remember a great deal about it, except you learnt discipline, which I'd already learnt to a certain extent in the scouts anyway.
And what about the RAF cadets?
After that, I still thought, well, I'd like to be interested in something, because this was the way of thinking though in those days anyway. So I think it might have come about because the drill hall at Deansbrook Road probably had a day or a week where you had an aircraft, probably either a German one or a British one, in the drill hall, and people would come along and sponsor a fighter or something like that. And other people like of my age would go along and become interested and perhaps join the RAF. So I remember going along there, and I think it must have been a Spitfire, because I remember sitting in the cockpit of it and having a good look around. So I said, well, I'm interested. How old are you? Well, I suppose I was probably about 15 or 16, so they said, well, you've got no chance at the moment. Why didn't you join the air cadets? And as I was interested in model aircraft and different things like that at the time, yes, good idea. So I think I went there for a few sessions, not enough to get a uniform actually, but I learned quite a bit about the RAF and their workings and different things. But I think that's when it came to me that all I'd be is ground staff. I don't mean that in a derogatory term. I mean they did a wonderful job, but it wasn't me. I didn't, you know.
Now, you'd signed up to join when you were about 17 and a half.
Right.
And what happened next? Did you go straight away? Or?
Well, straight away. Well, I didn't go then because when I did most of that was when I was still just over 17. But at 17 and a half, they called me almost dead on the time, I think it was 17 and a half. And you had to make your way to the drill hall with your stipulated one case, I suppose, or whatever it was, at a certain time, I believe about 10 o'clock in the morning or something.
So this would be September, I
presume? Well, August or September, whenever it was, I was 17 and a half, so let's see, what would I be? It would be September, wouldn't it? I have got the date still, but it's finding them at the moment.
I understand. Yeah. So You were called up and you went to the drill hall.
Went to the drill hall, and I remember we were a little group of us were loaded in the back of one of these great big army lorries, and we were taken from there down to London Station. I can't remember which one it was now, but we were then put on a train and we went to HMS Royal Arthur, which is up here at Skegness. the old Butlins, it was at the time, taken over by the Navy.
And what were you to train as? Was this just your basic seaman's training? As an ordinary?
No. To take me at the age of 17 and a half, I had to go to a certain group, or I opted to be a telegraphist. Telegraphist or communication branch, it was. Take 6 months training.
So you were trained as a telegraphist.
Yeah.
And what were your first impressions on arriving at Skegness? How did they take you? Because you'd arrived as a civilian, and how did they take you in?
It was quite good, actually. It was very easy going. They'd really given a lot of thought to the fact that you were not. It made a lot of difference that some of us were volunteers, of course. It was nice and easy, and it was an Butlins holiday camp, after all, you know, and you could see it was. And you were slowly processed into the Navy very well. They had dance halls there, which were used, of course, for the eating facilities.
I'll come on. So how did you arrived at the camp, and how did they kit you out? And, you know,
That I can't remember very much, but we were kitted out straight away with the full naval uniform, which is, you know, your hat and your normal dress, shoes you usually have in the Navy, although you do have boots as well, but shoes were given, overcoat, Gannett's Mac or whatever it was, and you were then billeted in the chalets.
And what were the chalets like? I mean, could you just describe how many were you in one, and what were they like?
Four to a chalet, and they were the bunk beds, which in fact they, I believe, were always like that. There was nothing new, especially they were all the holiday things. There was no heat, of course, in any of the chalets at that time. They were all unheated. The washhouse is a place between each row of chalets. You had a rush. Washhouse. The facilities were quite good, actually. So it was quite comfortable.
And what about, if we look at a typical day's training, then we can pick up various things off that. What time would your day start?
Well, there, I'm not sure. You remember, you were still being taken in slowly, so it was quite easy. But I imagine it must have been, well, they must have started about 9 o'clock, I imagine. I can't be absolutely sure, but it was always a call of reveille for breakfast, which of course you go then to one of the big halls, which is designated as your, you know, your place of eating.
And now, what was the food like? Because, I mean,
very good. Food was very good. In fact, very often, contrary to what you hear about the Navy, the food was very often very good. training at that camp wasn't very much in the way of training. You were being taught how nice the Navy was, and you were learning things like diseases you might catch if you're not careful, and all this sort of thing, you know. Really, lectures more than actual training. You did a little bit of square bashing, I believe, but not a lot. But nearly all lectures, and telling you what goes on in the Navy, film shows. You probably even got something like The Cruel Sea or something put on type of film, which is very good.
And what about training you as a telegraphist? Did they actually start with Morse code or anything?
Well, from there, which is basically, for most people, was just a basic training to send you to elsewhere. So the communication branch, when I went there, we were sent up to HMS Scotia.
Now, how long had you been at Royal Arthur?
Well, it'd only been a matter of a few weeks.
A month at most.
Probably a month at the most, yes. Won't be very long.
And where were you sent next? That would be in October then, would it?
About October. I should really have got some more information out for you, really. I didn't realise. It's difficult to remember. But it.
So where were you sent?
We were sent. Well, the group of us were then taken by another one of these lorries down to the station at Skegness, and then we were all put on a train, and from there we went, which was quite a long journey, through London up to HMS Scotia, which is here at Ayrshire, West Coast, Scotland.